You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 27th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's correct, ladies and gentlemen. My child's vacation continues, and so must mine. So must mine? So must mine. I don't know. I've been reduced to hanging out with a six-year-old for days on end now. You think I still have command of the English language? Well, not at the time I recorded this have I been hanging out with the six-year-old. But I'm projecting forward into time via this recording device. Ladies and gentlemen, it is the end of 2011, and as such, we are looking back on the year this week. Today on the program, conversation I had with Bobby Kennedy, one of my co-hosts from Ring of Fire, which is syndicated nationally on weekends, ringoffireradio.com. Mike Papantonio and I and Bobby every weekend. This was an amazing conversation. Following the execution of Troy Davis and Bobby Kennedy reflecting upon the inhumanity of capital punishment and its propensity to be administered incorrectly on innocent people, from his own experiences having had a father who was assassinated, having had a former brother-in-law who was incarcerated in Great Britain for over a decade on charges that turned out to be false, and having a cousin who is in jail for a murder that Bobby makes an argument, and I think a rather compelling one, that he did not commit. So I think you'll enjoy this interview. Also on the program today, an interview I did earlier this year with Bill Lozonik. I mentioned at the time it's a little bit dry, but it is an incredibly important interview with a guy who I've never heard on any other outlet, talking about the implications of CEO stock options and how that has financialized corporations that we do not perceive as being in the finance industry. And also, by audience demand, the famous Chris Rosen v. Chris Rosen moment where Chris Rosen, who was formerly the movie reviewer for this show, maybe he'll come back. I don't know. Matt is sitting there smirking because he's no longer with us. This was the interview that basically drove him off the show when Kyle, who does our tech stuff, insisted upon doing his Chris Rosen impersonation to Chris Rosen. And apparently it offended Chris, and he never came back.
For a little bit of context, the week earlier, we did not call Chris Rosen, and Kyle just called in as Chris Rosen. And a lot of our listeners did not realize that it was not Chris Rosen.
And the amazing thing is that the fake Chris Rosen actually suggested the movies as a joke in the first week that the following week the real Chris Rosen actually suggested. And it, well, what follows was sad, and I feel badly, sort of. And I have sort of apologized to Chris Rosen. Not the one, not the fake Chris Rosen. Although, if it will help, I'll do that too. So enjoy today's show, folks. I hope if you're on vacation, you're enjoying that. And don't forget, this time of year, maybe someone gave you a lottery, a scratch ticket for Christmas, and you scratch it, and you won $1 million. That would be a great time to become a Sam Cedar member. Or maybe you just won $500,000, in which case that would be a great time to become just a Majority Reporter member at majoritireport.fm. All right, folks. Tomorrow we'll have more best of. Friday will be all new content. Thursday we'll be doing a show on all of our Occupy Wall Street coverage. So stick around and enjoy. This week, the state of Georgia executed Troy Davis for allegedly murdering a police officer many years ago. The problem with this execution was that Davis's conviction was not based on any physical evidence and only the testimonies of people who later retracted and recanted their statements implicating Davis in this murder. People across America called legislators, legal experts, and the media hoping to do everything they could to prevent the execution of an innocent man, but the state of Georgia decided to go through the execution this past Wednesday evening. So, Bobby, in this past week on Wednesday at approximately 9 or 10 p.m. or so Eastern time, Troy Anthony Davis was killed by the state of Georgia by lethal injection. They used a chemical that they use essentially to kill animals, to euthanize animals. And this was done after he was in prison for 22 years or so. Had nearly come four times to being killed by the state of Georgia, and they finally got to him, and there was obviously a tremendous amount of doubt as to whether or not he was in fact guilty of the crimes he was convicted of.
Yeah, there was real doubt about it. As you know, and I think most people, most of our listeners know this, 7 out of the 9 eyewitnesses to the crime, supposed eyewitnesses of the crime, have recanted their testimony, said that they were lying at the time. The two that remain that did not recant, one of those is the principal suspect in the murder and, in fact, has confessed to the murder since the trial began. The jurors in the case asked that the sentence be commuted. A group of prison wardens from death sentence prisons all over the country have signed a petition in the last days asking that the sentence be commuted. And this was really interesting because they talked about the impacts of executing an innocent or probably innocent person on the prison personnel and prison staff who are required by their jobs to do that. And it was a very, very moving letter. Bob Barr, who is a huge advocate, former congressman, right-wing Republican congressman, from Georgia, a huge advocate for the death penalty, George Tenet, former FBI director, and many, many, many other prominent people and unusual people from both sides of the death penalty argument have said, wrote letters expressing in their opinion that this particular execution should not take place because the high probability that Troy Davis was actually innocent. And
well, and just to add to that, the Pope, William Sessions, the former director of the FBI, and the issue wasn't even necessarily that there was a high probability that he was innocent, but that the Georgia Paroles Board, who ruled on this earlier in the week, had set for their own standard back in 2007 that there shouldn't be any doubt as to his guilt. And I don't know in what world where you have no physical evidence, where you have only the testimony of 9 witnesses, and then all of a sudden, over the years, 7 recant, 1 a primary suspect, where you had at the beginning of the case, you had the police actually walked the witnesses through the crime scene prior to identifying Troy Davis. They showed a picture of Troy Davis before giving him into the lineup. They actually had him in a lineup with a different background than the other potential suspects. So there were so many elements of this case. And, you know, I don't know that sitting from where I am, I don't know whether or not this person was guilty or not guilty. But in this country, the issue isn't whether or not you're innocent. The issue is whether or not there is a reasonable doubt of your guilt. And it's almost impossible to imagine that the idea of all of those witnesses recanting, the idea of the way the police handled this investigation from the very beginning, did not constitute a reasonable doubt as to whether or not this guy was guilty.
That's right, Sam. And this example of it that the whole world saw, you know, of American democracy and the American judicial system at work, we're supposed to be the template. We're supposed to be, you know, everybody talks about, particularly the right wing of the Republican Party talks about it, says that America's supposed to be an exemplary nation. And that's a notion that my family, that I grew up with, that, yeah, we're supposed to be an exemplary nation. But that means we're supposed to model democracy and model the system of justice, not impose it on the rest of the world, but to model it. And, you know, this was not a very good example for the rest of the world. You had indignation and outrage, as you say, the Pope expressing and the rest and world leaders from across the world saying, you know, don't do this because it just makes America look bad. It makes our nation very, very difficult to defend. And particularly for those people, it's ironic that so many of the people who are for the death penalty claim that they're pro-life, you know, on other issues. And that level of hypocrisy is really strange, particularly, you know, in this case. Really, I think, broadcast the hypocrisy of that position. I'm grateful that the Catholic Church, which is my own religion on this issue, they've been very, very good. And they've said, you know, you can't be pro-life for unborn fetuses and for the death penalty. It's just morally inconsistent. You have to be against death and for creation, procreation, pro-life in both cases. We should, the state, the authoritarian power of the state should not be employed in killing human beings. And there's really, you know, there's no scientific or economic reason for it. It costs more to kill somebody, as we all know, than to keep them in prison for life. It does not act as an effective deterrent. And there's study after study after study that shows that. And all you have to do, Sam, as we've talked about before, is look at the states that have the death penalty. The states that kill the most people are also the states with the highest murder rates. So it's not preventing crime. It's not preventing violent crime.
Well, at the very least, we know. We know that it clearly doesn't deter it. And, you know, there is virtually no, I don't even hear. I mean, the interesting thing, Bobby, is that it used to be, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, when the data had not been compiled in a systemic way, you used to hear this argument that it was a deterrent. And I never hear that argument anymore. The only argument I hear for capital punishment is a strange, almost just one about justice, about, you know, the notion of closure. And of course, I would like to hear from, you know, those family members down the road if they actually got closure on this case, if it isn't just sort of a Pyrrhic sense of closure. But that's not any basis for us to make societal laws, because obviously victims of crimes are not in the best position, frankly, to make laws in response to their crime. And that's the very reason why we have laws that supersede the emotions of people. Bobby, I know that your family and yourself have your family have been the victims of violent crimes. And in fact, you have members of your extended family who have been convicted of crimes like these. And if you don't mind, I'd like to take a break. And when we come back, I'd love to hear your perspective on it.
We'll be right back with more about the death penalty and about Troy Davis and his execution this week, right here on Ring of Fire with Sam Cedar. Mike Papantonio, and myself, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
You can put a stick in my spokes. I can be the body of jokes. I can be the laughing stock. I can be the hoax, but I ain't gonna lose you.
We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, Bobby Kennedy and I are discussing the execution of Troy Davis by the state of Georgia that occurred earlier this week. So, Bobby, when we broke, I had asked if you wouldn't mind sharing with us your perspective on the death penalty, speaking as someone whose family has been subject and victims of violent crimes, and, in fact, who has family members who have been convicted of such crimes. Back in 2001, you wrote a prize-winning article that won many prizes for the Atlantic Monthly about a cousin of yours who was convicted of a violent crime. And I'm just curious from your perspective, give us that personal sense of what capital punishment means in that context.
And I'm happy to, Sam. Before we move on to that, I'd just like to, while we're still talking about kind of objective data, you know, one of the reasons even people who are kind of indifferent or pro-death penalty have looked, and even conservatives, especially conservative, genuine conservatives, who've looked at the DNA exonerations that have occurred over 138 people who were proven innocent by DNA evidence after DNA evidence was developed as a reliable scientific tool in forensics. 138 people have been released from jail and declared innocent. These were death row inmates because they didn't commit the crimes that they were convicted for. And so we know we're dealing with a system of justice that is not perfect. And to say that this system is so perfect, it's like saying the Bible is perfect, the Constitution is perfect. We all know that, you know, the Constitution is not a perfect document. It's the ideal of our nation has perfection to it, but we've never reached that ideal. And Benjamin Franklin said when he came out, he said, you know, we've given you a system. It's the worst possible system, but it's the best one we've got. In other words, any system you create is fallible. And to entrust this state that we admit and that we now know provably is fallible with the ultimate decision to actually kill people when we know we're killing innocent people is something that Americans of previous generations have never accepted and would never accept.
Now, Bobby, you know, we know that the arguments of, you know, this notion is ridiculous. The idea that we could possibly ever know the reality as to whether or not someone is actually guilty or not. And we do our best within the means that human beings, that fallible human beings have, which is why capital punishment is so barbaric. I mean, if you support capital punishment, you must accept that you are killing innocent people. It may be one out of 50. It may be one out of five. It may be one out of 100. But nevertheless, you will kill innocent people. And we're told that it's all about this notion now of closure for the family. And I wonder if that is enough and if that's even the case.
In my case, my father was killed, as you know, by an assassin, by Sirhan Sirhan. And my family, led by my Uncle Teddy, sent a letter to the prosecutor and to the judge immediately after my father's death, asking them not to seek the death penalty, because that was consistent with not only our Christian traditions, you know, Christ was a victim of the death penalty. And Christ repeatedly, the Catholic Church, has always said that the death penalty is, you know, at least in modern history, since Vatican II, has said it is barbaric and it's inhumane, and civilized nations should move away from it to humane forms of punishment and to a dignified, humane legal system. And, you know, Christ himself, when confronted with the death penalty and the significant times that he was confronted with his notions about the death penalty, he very clearly rejected it when the adulteress was brought before him, with a crowd of people who said she has admitted adultery. She's been proven an adulteress. The Mosaic law, the law at the time, requires us to stone her. He protested against it. And, you know, he said, let he who is not guilty cast the first stone. And the crowd dispersed till he was left alone with the woman. Well, that, you know, there's no clear statement against the death penalty. In the case of our family, I think Uncle Teddy felt that it was against our, and this is something we all talked about as a family, and there really was no dissension. Nobody wanted to see, nobody wanted the blood of Daddy's killer on our hands. You know, it was inconsistent with the ideals of our country, the things that Daddy represented. You don't stop violence by committing violent acts. You know, it's against intuition, it's against reason, it's against all of our Christian traditions. You know, you don't, Christ said, turn the other cheek. Anybody who considers themselves a Christian has got to be against the death penalty. Of course, my father is somebody that I think about every day. You never actually get closure when somebody dies, no matter how they die. But you can find peace, and I don't think that you find peace through vengeance or through vendetta or through resentment. I think, you know, every religious tradition in history has said you find it through forgiveness. And that's what we all have to practice, and that's what we all have to do. And that's one of the things that Teddy and my mother talked to us about at the time after my father's death, when we were putting together this appeal to the district attorney and the judge. Is this something that we wanted? Was this actually going to help us deal with our feelings, our anguish, our pain by killing the other person? And I think it only appeals to our most primitive, our, you know, the devil inside of us, our worst angels.
Bobby, let's take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear from the other perspective that you're coming from, in that you've had members of your family, and you've written eloquently in the Atlantic Monthly back in 2001 of a cousin of yours who was convicted of murder, and I'd like to hear your perspective from that side of it.
Yeah, I actually have two relatives, Sam, who have been convicted of murder and sentenced, and in both cases, the judges had announced their wishes that both of them, although in both jurisdictions the death penalty was not applicable, but in both cases the judges said that if they could administer the death penalty, they would. So it's something that I have direct experience with on both sides of the ledger.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. My name's Sam Cedar, here with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby has been talking to us about the case of Troy Davis, but more specifically, his own experiences with our criminal justice system, both as a member of a family that has been victimized by violent crime and with family members who have been convicted of violent crimes. Bobby, when we broke, you were telling me you have had two cousins who have been convicted of murder, who the prosecutors at the time were seeking the death penalty. Tell me about your perspective on the death penalty from that side of the ledger.
Well, this isn't any different than the statistical data that I talked to you about before, but I have personal experience with it about, you know, the death penalty, the death house exoneration, DNA exonerations, told us something shocking about the American system of justice, which is undeniable for everybody to see, that it is not perfect. You know, as a prosecutor myself, I knew that it wasn't perfect, because when I worked as a prosecutor in New York County at the DA's office, I could see that many decisions were made to prosecute people, that there was always a temptation to make those decisions politically. Now, for this very reason, under the laws of the United States, the role of the prosecutor is different than other plaintiff's attorneys. If you're a plaintiff's attorney in a private case. Your job is to win the case and fight as hard as you can to win your case, but then let the system ultimately make the decision. Fight as hard as you can for your client. But a prosecutor is a very different job. The prosecutor's job is not to convict criminals. It's to see that justice is done. So the prosecutor has to make an independent decision in each case as to whether or not the prosecution of this individual will serve justice. And one of the reasons for this mandate is that everybody knows that most prosecutors have political ambitions, and they can serve those ambitions by meeting the public demand for blood in high-profile cases. And oftentimes, the prosecutor is under tremendous pressure to show that he is a functioning prosecutor and that he's an effective prosecutor by convicting somebody. If there's a crime done, you got to find somebody and convict them to satisfy the public. And if he doesn't do that, maybe he won't move on to higher office. And, you know, for high-profile cases, there's a circus atmosphere oftentimes attached that incentivizes prosecutors to forget their duty to see that justice is done, instead serve the public demand for blood. And in two cases that are very, very close to me, that where family members were involved, I had direct experience with these. One of these was my cousin Michael Skakel, who was convicted of a crime that had taken place 27 years before when he was a 15-year-old boy, and that he was never a suspect for then or afterwards. And it was a girl who he cared deeply about. The last person seen with the girl had been his brother, but at the time of the murder, it was proven that he was at 12 miles away watching the first episode of Monty Python with 5 eyewitnesses. He had a bad lawyer. And that's really why many people are on death row. They just had a bad lawyer. Michael Skakel had the worst lawyer in the state of Connecticut. And because of that, this was a case that a first-year law student could not have lost because the evidence against him was so flimsy. There were so many witnesses who would testify that he was elsewhere. Those witnesses were either not prepped or they weren't brought before the court. And he got convicted. And he got convicted because there was huge publicity, and, you know, Mark Furman and Dominic Dunn drove this orgy of public demand, and there was this idea that here was a kid who was, you know, related to the Kennedys, and therefore he must be rich and powerful, and that he had somehow escaped the law. But if you actually read the evidence and look at what happened in that trial, you see it was just he is an innocent man who is now serving essentially life in prison for a crime that he absolutely did not commit. And since that time, the people who did commit the crime have almost certainly, you know, I got a call from a person called Tony Bryant, who was the cousin of the basketball player Kobe Bryant. And he said to me, I've been keeping a secret for 27 years. I was there on the night that Martha Moxley was killed, and I was with the people who killed her, and they took Michael Skakel's golf club from the Skakel family lawn. They said they were going to go get her. I left them at the time, but the next day they came to me and said that they had killed her, and they said that many times thereafter. I then called the people, the two men who were almost, there was three men involved. One of them was a kid who committed suicide almost very shortly afterwards. He had been a 16-year-old boy at the time. The other two, I ran them down. One was living in Portland, Oregon. The other was living in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And I just surprised them with phone calls to their home. And I asked them, were you there that night? There's no police records. It showed that they were there. They were never interviewed by the police, and they were never suspects in the crime, and there was never any discussion of them being there. Another problem that Michael had was just very, very bad police work, and it was a 27-year-old case. And the only forensic evidence that they had was hairs that were from an African-American, and one of these gentlemen was an African-American. that were found on Martha Moxley's body, and nobody knew how could an African-American be in Greenwich and not be noticed that night. So both of these gentlemen told me on the phone, and of course I recorded their telephone conversations, that they were indeed there, that they had been with Tony Bryant, and that they had known Martha Moxley, and one of them had a crush on her and was looking for her that night. But again, just like in the case of Troy Davis this week, this was evidence that prosecutors, once the system gets you, it does not want to let you go. It wants to see that its form of justice is done, whether or not you're innocent or not. And that, you know, Michael Skakel is suffering a life in prison, having never seen his son since the baby was born, except a few instances inside these prison walls, and he is an innocent man. Now, the other person has been exonerated, and he is my former brother-in-law, Paul Hill, who's the father of my wonderful niece, Saoirse Kennedy, and Paul was married to my sister, Courtney.
Bobby, let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about your other member of your family, Paul Hill, who's been exonerated in the next segment. We are back on Ring of Fire. My name is Sam Cedar. I'm here with Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio. And Bobby and I have been talking about the execution of Troy Davis this past week. And Bobby has been giving us his perspective, coming both as a member of a family that has been victims of violent crimes and as a person who has close family members who have been convicted of violent crimes. Bobby, before we speak about Paul Hill, your other member of your family who was exonerated, just in terms of your cousin Michael Skakel, who still remains in prison, and you have this information that two individuals who showed up nowhere in the police reports have actually admitted to you on tape that they were there. They were
right. And the third individual who was with them has told me that he was with them. He brought them to Greenwich that night, that they told him that they were going to, they didn't say they were going to murder Martha Moxley. They said they were going to go out and get her and take her caveman style. In other words, hit her over the head and rape her. And they had already gotten a golf club from the Skakel's lawn, which was the murder instrument. These were big men. They were, you know, Michael Skakel at that time was a little tiny kid. He weighed barely 100 pounds, and he was in love with Martha Moxley.
Here's my question, is that once you have that information, what I think people don't understand is why don't the courts look at that? I mean, that seems to be an amazingly large gap in the account of what happened at that time if the police weren't even aware of these people's presence.
Well, you know, you have to go, once the system has you, you have to go through the appeals process, and you can base an appeal on new evidence, but the threshold for that is so high in most states. For example, that's the same case that Troy Davis had, and Troy Davis had a situation where the only evidence against him, there was no physical evidence. There was no fingerprints. There was, you know, no blood evidence, no DNA evidence, nothing else. The only evidence against him was this tainted evidence of 9 eyewitnesses, one of the two who haven't recanted, who is a prime suspect in the crime. 7 of them have recanted, and they've recanted because of seeing new evidence about the crime or because their conscience required them to recant, and they've said, I was lying. Well, that is new evidence. So you would think that even if one of them said that, the courts would reconsider it. But the threshold for reconsidering based upon new evidence is so high, and the bias among judges and prosecutors is such a barrier to reopening old trials that they've already won. They've already checked that off. They don't want to go back. And it's almost impossible to do in this country, and it's disheartening. for me and demoralizing because I'm somebody, my father was Attorney General of the United States. I grew up believing that, you know, in the American system of justice and a little bit, yeah, in its infallibility. But my father had enough experience with it. You know, when I was a kid, I went to the Hoffa hearings when I was a kid. And I saw Hoffa, he got out because he bribed jurors. So I saw that the system is not a perfect system. And you have to, and one of the things my father recognized about our country is an exemplary nation, not because the system is perfect, but because we continue to try to perfect it.
Now that there's like a better DNA technology, couldn't they have taken the DNA of that hair?
Unfortunately, there is no, the hair was lost. The evidence has not been saved from the, you know, most of the evidence, I'd say 95% of the evidence from the physical evidence has been lost because of sloppy police work. Well, just based on that, you know, an attorney, a decent attorney would get you off. They'd say, you know, why the heck didn't this police, they're trying to take this guy's life away. You know, they should have a burden of keeping, preserving the evidence, but they didn't. So it was all based on, his conviction was based upon a guy who admitted one witness, essentially, who said that Michael Skakel, while they'd been in a drug rehab together, had admitted to him that he had committed the murder. And Michael Skakel denied that. There was 9 people who said that that person was a pathological liar. The same person admitted that he had been on heroin when he testified at the trial. He subsequently admitted at the second trial that he had been on heroin. Then he died of a heroin overdose before the final trial, and his testimony was played on videotape. So, and that's what convicted Michael Skakel. That and a prosecutor who, you know, put together a very, very damning video of Michael for his closing argument that used all kinds of visual techniques that are probably illegal in order to convict him. And Michael just had the worst lawyer in the history of Connecticut. But let me tell you about Paul Hill.
Please.
Paul Hill was one of the Guilford Four. He was an Irish kid, 18 years old. It was an elite team of IRA killers who planted a pub in Guilford, in a little town that was a gathering place for military personnel from neighboring bases. And one of these bombs went off in a pub and it killed a bunch of innocent people, including some people who were military. The local police were under tremendous pressure, you know, to convict somebody. So, and this IRA squad was the best, most successful, best, you know, I use that in quotes, but most successful elite team in the history of the IRA. They committed dozens and dozens of very horrific bombings, and they were not caught for years later. And all of this, incidentally, you can see in a movie called In the Name of the Father, which starred Daniel Day-Lewis, and is about my brother-in-law, about Paul Hill and his, you know, fight for justice and the 15 years that he spent in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And the judge who said he only wished that he could give Paul Hill the death penalty. The local police went out because they couldn't catch this IRA squad. And they went out and they rounded up 4 people, just random people off the street, including my brother-in-law, Paul. They brought them into little rooms in the police station. They beat them up and then they put a gun into Paul's mouth and cocked the trigger and said, sign this confession. And he signed the confession. And then they said, oh, since you're signing that one, sign this other one. And he signed another confession that was the basis of his conviction for the murder of a Belfast police officer at a time when he could prove that he had not even, by his passport, that he had not even been in Belfast. He was in England at that time. But, you know, of course, he was going to sign anything they put in front of him. So he served 15 years in prison. And during that time, the IRA group that had committed, now the IRA, these elite squads were told, never confess to anything. If you're caught, never confess to anything. But this group was told, because so many people were exercised and upset, the world community, about the conviction of the Guilford Four, which included my brother-in-law, And people were upset because they knew they were innocent. There was so much evidence that they were innocent, and it had become such a political issue that this group was told, if you ever do get caught, you should confess to this one crime. So they ultimately, 7 years later, they were caught, and they all confessed. And they knew, you know, when the police investigate a crime, they always, well, at least, you know, good police departments always withhold some evidence from the public release, so that if somebody comes forward to confess to the crime, that there's something that is not in the public forum, so that they can ask them about to confirm. Because a lot of times people confess for various reasons, confess to crimes that they haven't committed. So in order to weed out those people, you keep some of the evidence secret and then ask them about this. Well, this elite team was able to answer all of those questions. They knew how the job had been done, where the wigs were, you know, where they had purchased the wigs, where they had hidden them and afterwards, and et cetera, because they were came in these elaborate disguises. And they had a suitcase that they brought into this pub that had a button on the handle that would release a false bottom, would release another suitcase from it. So they came in with this suitcase, put it under the table, released the false suitcase, then walked out of the bar and left another suitcase under their table, concealed there, that had the bomb in it. They confessed to all that. They told exactly how they'd done it. So the prosecutors knew that the Guilford Four were innocent and Paul Hill was innocent. Nevertheless, they kept them in jail for another 8 years. And I went to the trial. They were finally all released. But Paul then had to go stand trial on the second count, which was the murder of this Belfast police officer. And I went to his trial in England. It was, I think, a four-week trial that we had over there. And, you know, it was really, it was extraordinary how far, how hard even the prosecutors at that time were fighting to keep this man in jail when any seven-year-old would have said, he's obviously innocent. They, you know, the police have already admitted putting a gun in his mouth and getting him to sign these confessions. Why don't you just admit that he's innocent and let him go? But once the system has you, they won't. And, you know, these are the two systems, the British system of justice and the U.S. system of justice upon which it's based, that are regaled around the world as the best systems of justice in the world. And yet they're imperfect. And we have to admit that.
So, Bill, walk us through this. How is it that CEO pay is so much larger than that of their workers? And is this a recent phenomenon? How long has this been around? And what are the primary driving factors of this disparity?
Okay, well, it really started in the 1980s. In fact, and the main driver of it has been stock-based compensation, particularly stock options. And the fact is that stock options for CEOs have been around for a long time, really since 1950, after corporate executives lobbied Congress to get stock options taxed with the capital gains tax rate. Now, you know, with all the talk about low taxes or no taxes in the United States now, you have to remember that in the 1950s, the tax rate on the top bracket for personal income taxes was 91%, even as high as 92%. And executives didn't want to pay that on their high salaries, so they got Congress to allow them to have stock options taxed at the capital gains tax rate.
Now, I want to make one point here, too, because just because I think sometimes people misunderstand. When you talk about 91%, that's over a threshold, probably back in that time. That's over any dollar over about $400,000, which in this day and age would be a couple million.
Yeah, at that time it was over $200,000, I think. But anyway, yeah, so it would be a pretty high high salary in today's terms. But
only those dollars that are above that number.
Marginal rate, sure. It's right. A marginal rate, yeah. But once they got up there, they didn't want to pay that rate. So that was allowed. It was a type of stock option where you had to hold it for 6 months after you exercised it, and then before you sold the stock, and then you could take the income at the 25% capital gains tax rate. Now, in the 1960s, there was a backlash against this in Congress. In fact, the leader of the opposition to this tax privilege was Albert Gore, Al Gore's father, senator from Tennessee. And in fact, by 1976, the privilege had been eliminated, which is interesting because it meant that really at that time Congress was willing to say to CEOs, no, you can't have special privileges.
Now, can I ask you, because I think this is important to understand how we go from 1976 to now.
Yeah.
But back at that time, the CEOs want to basically figure out a way in which to avoid these high marginal tax rates.
Yeah.
What comes first in this process in which they got this legislation changed? I mean, does someone in a room basically come up with the idea of like, hey, if we pay you your part of your compensation in the form of stock options, then it'll be easier from a legislative perspective, a political perspective, to get the taxes changed on those stock options, and so you can sort of escape this tax rate. How does that happen?
Okay, so what happened was that actually after 1976, the people who wanted to use stock-based compensation, particularly stock options, actually stopped focusing on the tax rate. For one thing, the personal tax rate had come down, although it was still the top marginal tax rate was about 70%. In the late 1970s, the capital gains rate had come up to about 49%. So the differential was not as great, for one thing. But what really changed it was that you had a lobby, which was a new lobby, that came out of Silicon Valley. It was really the National Venture Capital Association and American Electronics Association. They wanted to use stock options for a completely different purpose. And that is...
I'm sorry, Bill, I got to stop you. We're hearing a beeping. Are you hearing a beeping on your end?
No. Okay. No. Do you still hear it?
Nope. Gone.
Okay, good. They wanted to have stock options not for top executives, but for professional, technical, and administrative personnel to try to attract them to come to startups. Because this is in the 70s, it was when Silicon Valley really started getting going. And they then got some legislation in the Tax Reform Act of 1981 that facilitated this. And from that time to the present, it's not the tax advantages of stock options that are important. It's just stock options that, in fact, you pay personal income taxes on. Of course, and at the same time, the same lobby was really the first lobby that really tried to get tax rates down in general, tying low taxes to innovation, which is still the mantra today.
And yeah, this is the, in fact, I mean, we hear certainly Republicans and sadly sometimes some Democrats arguing that it's our tax rates, even though we're at an all-time low by any measure whatsoever of a tax burden, that somehow it is stifling business.
Yeah, and basically you could say that, you know, at some level tax rates can be too high, but that's not been the case for, you know, over 30 years, and they really come way too low. So now you have a low tax regime and all kinds of loopholes for which are mainly to the benefit of richer people, and you also have a widespread use of stock options, but nobody's really worried about what they worried about before. That is the tax privilege. That after 1981, it has nothing to do with it. Virtually all the stock options that are exercised by executives or broad-based stock options by people in companies like Apple and Cisco, where virtually or most of the people have stock options, are taxed at the personal income tax rate. So it ceases to be that.
So in other words, and let me just see if I got this straight. So initially, the idea of compensation in the form of stock options was a way to avoid high marginal tax rates. And then subsequently, it was a way for startups to provide compensation without actually having to go cash out of pocket.
That was one of the things. And the other thing is you have to remember is that in the 1980s, right through the 1980s, so that's changed since then, they were competing for labor with people who were at companies like IBM, Motorola, Texas Instruments, where basically you still had the notion of a career with one company. You had a defined benefit pension. The notion was you were going to be there for your career. Now you had to get those same people to come to startups where inherently your employment security is uncertain. And this was the way in which people were lured to startups. Now, once this started happening, and also once the startup phenomenon, particularly in the electronics industry, started making people lots of money, people in the large established companies, particularly at the top, started saying, hey, we're underpaid. let's get our pay up. And they got boards to give them stock options. It also was the fact that from 1982 till 2000, you had the longest stock market boom in U.S. history, and anybody who was paid in stock options or stock-based compensation is going to make money. And so I call it kind of contagious compensation. You start getting high incomes in one part of the economy, and other people want them. Top executives basically started saying, we have to keep up with others. So it becomes kind of a comparison of people who have made lots of money through IPOs, people who have made lots of money with startups, but also with then increasingly with other executives at other companies. And by the late 1980s, all the companies are looking at what other companies are paying, and stock options is the way you really get your income up.
Now, Bill, let me ask you this, and before we have to take a break.
Yeah.
But when you talk about this contagious compensation, when you talk about this, which sounds as, almost like the same way an arms race runs,
yeah.
Was this a function because executives felt like we can't retain quality employees, or was it simply because I want what the Joneses have? I mean, in other words, was this a question of ego, or was there actually a fundamental business reason to maintain this to raise this compensation?
Okay, for the top executives, I think it was partly ego, but it was also a change in ideology. And up until the 1980s, when you still had the notion that you didn't lay off lots of people, that you in a large corporation you had careers with one company, not just the people at the top, but going right through the organization, top executives' pay was still largely tied to what other people got in the organization. In the 1980s, with the deal decade and all the takeovers and basically the rise of Wall Street as really making money out of trading rather than long-term investment in companies, the notion set in that basically the only important people were the people at the top.
All right, well, Bill, let's stop there. Okay, so we have this change in ideology where the most important people are the people at top. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about why this is such a destructive business ideology. So, Bill, when we broke, you were talking about how there was a rise of an ideology in the 80s amongst the the business elite, I mean, the CEOs, that essentially they were the most important aspect of a company. A shift from the idea that a company had a responsibility to its workers and you would maintain the same workforce, and there was a shared sense of success that was shared throughout the company. This ideology changed in part, you say, because there were so many people who were making money on stock options and whatnot, that it created a different dynamic.
Yeah, it changed. It changed. That was one of the reasons it changed. It also changed, I think, because of the rise of Japanese competition. Many companies, rather than confront the competition and really invest in the net, in the new technologies, and just started saying, well, let's just make money out of what we have. And There was a number of influences on this. There was also the fact that the population as a whole, really through changes that had taken place in the 1970s, was looking much more to the stock market for returns on their savings. So there was a general legitimacy to trying to get your income from the stock market that hadn't existed before. And then this, really coming out of business schools, was really ratified in a sense by the notion that companies, what they were supposed to do is maximize shareholder value. And this is actually the form the ideology took in the 1980s, and it hadn't existed before. And this basically became an ideology of top managers who then said, well, we can do what we want. We can lay off workers. We can pay ourselves a lot. Whatever we want to do, we can do, as long as we are returning value to shareholders. And then one of the ways in which they did this, there's basically two ways you can return value to shareholders. One is by paying them dividends, and one is by getting the stock price up and getting them stock price appreciation. And in the 80s and 90s, if you look at the data, you see that you basically have double-digit stock price appreciation on average for the, let's say, the S&P 500 companies over the 80s and 90s. And in part, this is because there are some companies that are really innovative, particularly coming out of the new economy, let's say a Microsoft or an Intel in the 80s and 90s. To some extent, it's because, particularly in the late 90s, people start speculating and they start driving the stock prices up then.
So Bill, let me just recap to where we are here, because this is really important. So basically what happened is sometime in the 80s, you had these large corporations went from an ideology where job number one was the product that they were making, the service that they were providing, and it also had a tangential ideology that because their output into the marketplace was the most important aspect of their existence, that meant that there was value in everybody who contributed to that. But then sometime in the 80s, particularly because CEOs were actually getting paid in terms of stock, the idea of almost seeing their company as a financial product, one that could be provide returns to investors rather than an entity that produced something or provided a service, it became financialized. And so the companies began to organize themselves and to make business decisions based on that criteria.
That's right. That's right. I think that's well put. And they basically the stock price became the way in which you judge performance of the company. And if executives could make more money because they could get stock prices up, then they were judged as being good performers. And so that was great. You just you get stock price up and you make money from your stock options. Now,
I mean, is it wrong for me to characterize this like that CEOs became almost like the CEOs at one time of their company, but also the CEOs of their own little cottage industry in terms of if they did something with the company, it would actually raise revenues for them personally through their stock options.
Yeah, so you have basically their personal interests, which are supposedly in the interest not only of the company and the economy as a whole, take over, But in fact, when you start peeling it away, you see that pursuing their own personal interests in this way is not in the interests of their company. They're laying off lots of people and lots of people they shouldn't be laying off, and it's not in the interest of the economy as a whole. And the other new thing which comes in, which then it becomes almost an obsession, I would say an obsession, and has become an obsession of top executives by the 2000s, but really starts also in the 1980s, is you then say, well, let's give our stock price a little help. Let's help get it up there. So even if we're not innovative, or even if people aren't speculating in the stock, we can do something about it. And that we do something about it by buying back our stock. And in 1982, the Securities and Exchange Commission gave basically executives a safe harbor to buy back massive amounts of stock on the open market, which could have the effect of boosting their stock prices. And this was done, I would say, not systematically, sporadically in particular times in the 1980s, but by the 2000s, it becomes systematic. And for the S&P 500, in 2003, the average buybacks per company was about $300 million. 2007, it had quadrupled to about $1.2 billion per company. Now, that then helped boost stock prices, and
it all contributed to that financialization of the company. Well, listen,
Bill. And the very people who are making this decision now are getting the direct benefit out of the greatest direct benefit of it.
So let's sum up here, Bill, because we're running out of time. So basically what we've seen is that over the past 20 to 30 years, corporations in this country have become so focused on their value to shareholders as a financial instrument rather than an entity that produces goods or services that they have changed the way that they do business in such a way that ultimately hurts business.
Yes, and it hurts us. I mean, I can give you lots of specific examples. I'll just give you one. We pay drug prices in the United States that are twice as high as anybody else pays in the world. This has been debated in Congress for 20 years or more, and the drug companies argue that they have to have high profits because that's what funds R&D in the United States. They do more R&D in the United States because of the high drug prices. You start looking at companies like Johnson & Johnson, Merck, Amgen, Pfizer, and you see what they do with majority of their profits. They use it to buy back their stock.
Interesting.
So they're not using it for R&D. They're using it to manipulate their stock price.
So, in fact, they've substituted R&D for making themselves a more attractive financial instrument, which ultimately just simply benefits those people at the top of these corporations.
That's right. And one more point about this, where the Securities and Exchange Commission also made this easier in 1991 by saying to top executives that they basically could sell their stock that they acquired through stock options immediately after exercising it. Now, up to that point, as top executives under the Securities Exchange law, the top executives had to wait 6 months before selling stock so that they couldn't make money out on short swings in stock price and basically through insider trading. The Securities Exchange Commission changed the rule on stock options to say that the 6 months started from the grant date rather than from the exercise date. Now, since all stock options take at least a year to vest after they're granted, it means that the instant that an executive, since that point, since May 1991, exercises the stock options, they can sell the stock, and they almost always do. And so basically, they are really looking for the opportunity to sell the stock as quickly as possible and make money for themselves, or at the right point.
Right.
They have a 10-year window to do this. The other thing is that they don't actually announce the day they do buybacks. So there's only certain insiders who know when they actually do the buybacks. They announce a program to do buybacks, but if a company is today buying back, let's say, 100 million or 200 million worth of stock, which some of the large companies can do, only some people on the inside are going to know that they're going to get that price boost as a result of it. And there's likely to be a lot of insider trading that, and there's been no suits against insider trading of this type that I know of. Because, in fact, they don't have to announce the date, and they're allowed to sell the stock immediately.
Well, there's all kinds
of things that have gotten stacked in the favor of executive pay. And the last thing is that any time the stock price goes down and they don't make money on their options, the boards just throw lots more options at them, and then when the stock price goes up, they start making money. So they benefit, actually, from the volatility of their stock. When, in fact, what we would think we'd want is kind of a steadily rising stock price of a company that's innovative, doing well over time. In fact, when you look at it, you see that the executives are making huge amounts of money, not because they have a steadily rising stock price, but out of the volatility of their stock. So there's all kinds of ways in which this has contributed to higher executive pay. And then over time, you then get a standard which says, you know, 200 times the average worker, well, that's not enough. It has to be 300 times or 350 times. That's okay. And these kind of new benchmarks become the kind of the new normal and are then taken for granted. And this just is this kind of, it's more than a creep. It's a
rush.
Compensation over time.
Bill, we've run out of time, but this is fascinating stuff, and it explains a tremendous amount. It's essentially the corruption of the premise of corporate America, and I appreciate your making it very clear how and through what processes it's happening.
Okay, well, happy to do it.
Christopher Rosen of MovieLine.com.
I'm actually at Movie Phone.
Big Shot Senior Editor.
Vertical Editor.
Here is your theme song. You sit in a dimly lit room watching movies and you dress like a slob.
I'm actually in an office now.
Jimmy Reefer Cakes got to ask you, said, man, how'd you get that job? I said, how did you get that job?
That's right. How did you get that job? Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Rosen, welcome to the program, Chris.
Hey, Sam, I thought you forgot about me after last week.
Well, where have you been?
I've been waiting for you to call. Never call anymore.
You were on last week. What did you recommend last week?
I recommended Horrible Bosses.
What, the Bosses?
Well, I was going to recommend that this week, douchebag.
What?
What?
Wait, what did you recommend last week? The Bosses?
I don't know what I recommended last week. It wasn't on.
Horrible Bosses.
Hire the Bosses?
I was not on last week.
Tell me again. You just said Hire the Bosses.
Horrible Bosses. That's what I'm going to recommend. It's a very funny movie.
Wait, you recommended that last week?
Charlie Day is in it. He's very funny. Jason Sudeikis. All these guys, Sam, I don't know if you've heard about this movie, but they all team up to murder their bosses.
Horrible Bosses. You recommended that last week.
I don't believe I did, but it's a really funny movie. I think you should definitely check it out.
Wait, you did? Didn't you just...
Yes, I'm recommending it right now. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a good movie.
No, you recommended it.
You should really see it in Blu-ray.
What? Say that again?
What was that?
You should really see that in Blu-ray. Horrible Bosses. I recommended it last week. It came out on Blu-ray.
That's what I just said. You recommended it last week. It came out on Blu-ray.
I don't know if it came out this week or last week on Blu-ray, but it's good. I don't have a Blu-ray player, but sure, you could watch it.
Okay. Well, wait. You just – last week you said you recommended it because it was on Blu-ray.
This week I'm saying it.
No, you said
– I said it last week.
That's right. You said it last week.
This week.
So I recommended it last week. I thought we could reuse the recommendation.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. I'm just saying this week would be good to watch Horrible Bosses.
Didn't you just say you recommended it last week?
I didn't. You were playing audio tapes of me saying that, but I'm telling you now to recommend it.
I'm not playing audio tapes of you saying it last week. I'm a little
confused. I don't remember being on last week, but sure.
All right. So you wait.
So Horrible Bosses is a very funny movie. I think you should check it out. I don't know. If I recommended it last week, you know, maybe you watched it?
I remember he also recommended – what was the show he recommended last week?
Wait, didn't you recommend a TV show last week?
Probably Parks and Recreation?
No.
It was Whitney.
I
recommended Whitney last week.
You recommended Whitney last week. Yeah, what is that show?
Oh, I would never recommend that piece of shit.
Wait, you just said you recommended it.
Well, I didn't, though. I recommended Horrible Bosses because that was funny. Whitney's bad. Whitney's all kinds of bad.
That's not what you said last week.
Oh, Matt, look, you decided to talk now.
Yeah, Matt talks? What do you mean?
Matt's a douchebag. Where's that drop? Get that drop ready.
What drop?
You can use that cut. Hang on. Matt's a douchebag.
All right, wait a second. All right, I'm confused with you guys. All right.
Hey, Matt, why don't you go play like Gears of War on PS3 or something?
I've already told you, Rosen. Gears of War is on Xbox 360.
I mean,
Matt's talking himself now.
All right. So, listen, Whitney is not. You don't like Whitney.
Whitney, I wouldn't recommend. I think that show's garbage.
All right.
We don't recommend television shows on this because if I did, I would just tell you to watch Parks and Recreation every week.
All right. Now, wait a second. So, what are you recommending this week?
Horrible Bosses is a great movie.
Dude, you recommended that last week.
Oh, that's right. Well, I'd recommend it again because it's really funny.
All right. Do you have a second recommendation?
I actually have two other recommendations.
Hold on for one second. Oh, I should remind people that what we do on this recommendation is a Netflix or a
Amazon
streaming.
On demand.
What? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. So a Netflix or an Amazon streaming, and because I'm not allowed to leave my house.
Right, that's a sad life you live, Sam.
It is.
But for the rest of us, you know, there's a whole world out there.
I understand. What is that second movie?
I was going to recommend Margin Call. I know you love it when I recommend things I haven't seen, but this is available on Amazon right now. It's actually in theaters, so you could, you know, watch it, something that people are actually talking about instead of waiting like 6 months to watch something.
Wait a second. You haven't watched it?
I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet, but I plan on doing it. It's on Amazon, and it's also in theaters, but, I mean, if you don't want to go out to the theater, you can watch it. It's about the financial crisis. Tons of people.
Simon Baker's in it. Demi Moore. I mean, you like things I haven't seen before, so, I mean, I think this is a good recommendation. You can see it now. It's in theaters.
Yeah, okay. Why haven't you had time to see it?
Yeah, Matt, why haven't I had time to see it?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
What?
Why are you asking me that?
Because you're doing a bad impression of me?
What? Sam, you're sitting right across from me. Am I doing an impression of Chris Rosen?
No, you're sitting there doing an impression of you. So Rosen, why haven't you had time to see it?
I'm a busy guy, Sam. I don't have time to see these movies.
Well, what do you do at Movie Phone?
A lot of stuff we do at Movie Phone. It's a great website. You should come check it out. Click around, buy some tickets.
But wait,
check out some more galleries.
I don't understand. You work for Movie Phone, but yet you don't have time to see movies.
Well,
I'm a vertical editor, Sam. I have a lot of deadlines to meet.
You have other deadlines to meet? Like what?
I don't just do this show, Sam.
No, I know you don't just do this show, but what other deadlines could you possibly have?
Do you know how many verticals there are in movies?
How many verticals there are in movies?
I don't even understand what that means.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I'm a vertical editor.
No, I know you're a vertical editor, but what does that mean there are verticals in movies?
Each movie is a vertical, Sam.
Each movie is a vertical?
Yeah.
I don't understand what that means. Rosen, how did you get that job?
A lot of hard work. You know, not easy. So we got it. That's good.
Now, what does that mean, verticals in movies?
Yeah, there's a lot of movies, Sam. I don't know what to tell you.
A lot of movies. Okay, so Bad Boss.
So Horrible Bosses, it's so good, you should watch it again. Margin Call, I haven't seen it, so that means it's probably good, right? That's how it goes.
Now, wait a second. How many other movies, I mean, what movies did you see this week?
This week, I don't think I went to any screenings. So, I saw Tower Heist. I had to see that. That was great. A lot of fun.
Tower Heist? Oh, yeah. Is that one with Ben Stiller? Why didn't you recommend that one?
Because you can't go out to the movies.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. And,
but, you know, in 6 months, I would recommend Tower Heist. It's stupid, but it's a lot of fun.
Right, of course. Stupid, but fun. What else?
This week, I don't think I saw any other screenings.
That's 90 minutes of movies that you watched this week for your job at Movie Phone.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think of what else I even watched this week. There wasn't really that much.
Well, there was nothing vertical. You never go
back.
There's
a lot of verticals. Just, you know, there wasn't a lot of me watching movies.
All right. Well,
anyway, Sam, this has been fun. I'm going to play myself off. And,
what's the matter?
What's up? Nothing. I'm a very busy guy. I got stuff to do.
Like, what are you going to go do now?
Just, you know, the verticals. A lot of stuff in those verticals.
Okay.
I got to start working on the Twilight vertical. It's coming up in a few weeks.
Twilight vertical? The Twilight vertical?
Yeah, I got a lot of work to do for the upcoming blockbuster movie, Twilight, Breaking Dawn.
Oh, one of our Chris Rosens hung up.
Which one? I can't tell.
Yeah.
Well, Chris Rosens, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Sam.
Oh, my God.
And I think the best was real Chris Rosen saying, "You're playing audio clips of me from past shows."
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I think he was genuinely pissed. And, you know, the amazing thing is he never listens to the show. So he wouldn't even know that we introduced a Chris Rosen impersonator last week.
So he thinks it's me.
He thinks it's you.
And I have the incredible talent of speaking over my own impressions with my normal voice.
Well, that actually is, you can learn that. You can actually learn to do that if you're really good at it. You can learn to do that. That was pretty amazing, folks. he recommended Margin Call and Horrible Bosses, which is amazing because Kyle, the other Chris Rosen recommended Horrible Bosses last week.
Hey everyone, Matt here. Continuing today's best of show, I've put together two great clips of Sam talking about the death of Osama bin Laden from May. They're short ones, but they're really good. One is a personal pick of mine, and another one was chosen by Jay from the Best of the Left. And after that, by popular demand from all of you, I've included the debate Sam and I had back in August on the London riots. The conversation certainly grew throughout the week, but this is the very first one, the one that kicked it off and got all of you so involved. If members would like to go back and listen to the rest of that conversation Sam and I had on the London riots, it's in the August 9th to the August 12th members portion of the show. Enjoy!
Hey, I did it. I got that mofo. Told you I would, dead or alive. I got him. I got him. I won. What do y'all think about that? I won. America, I did it. Oh, ended. All right, folks. Long night last night, obviously. Apparently, Osama bin Laden is dead and buried in the ocean. That's going to be a big thing that we talk about on the program today, because apparently there's not going to be any other news for the next 6 weeks. That's it. And then, of course, it's going to mean nothing. But the one thing that strikes me about this is just how much news we have had in the past week or two between the birth certificate and the death of Osama bin Laden, which at the end of the day will be utterly meaningless. It will be utterly meaningless. Unless Obama decides to use the political cachet that comes with having killed Osama bin Laden. I mean, unless he decides to use this as a pretext for ending our war. Does anybody have an idea as to why we are still in Afghanistan at this point? I mean, what are we doing? Osama bin Laden living the life of luxury in a Donald Trump-like villa in Pakistan. And they say it was $1 million villa in Pakistan. My sense is that $1 million in Pakistan, when you build $1 million house, probably worth, $10-12 million here. He's living the life of Donald Trump in, I guess, just 40 miles outside of Islamabad, around the corner from the Pakistani West Point. And yet, we are still bombing people in Afghanistan. Can someone explain that to me? If our war on terror, whatever we're doing in Afghanistan, doesn't end now, when will it end? Alex JS 85, Sam, despite knowing people lost in the attacks, I just feel a sense of unease at the recent bizarre events. It seems perverse to misplace death for justice. It seems perverse to celebrate the extrajudicial assassination of people the government deems unsavory. It seems perverse, at least to me, to celebrate more death as closure for the death of many others. But that might be colored by my own sense of the injustice of the death penalty. I caught this tweet last night, and it really spoke to me. Two things that cost the U.S. over a decade and $100 billion to do. Get a man on the moon and kill Osama bin Laden. Obama's tone of accomplishment last night's speech at the death of a person, despite who that person is, along with a previous tweet, more truly to me about the trajectory of our society. The people who celebrated in front of the White House last night, as Jeremy Scahill said on Democracy Now! Today, are morons. I just hope that we can see this death as a reason to end our wars. Perhaps the death of Hitler was seen, but I doubt that will happen. Justice does not mean eye for an eye in our society anymore. We have a process, and we can't keep perpetuating a system of bigger fish is allowed to kill littler fish based upon the implicit authority over morality based upon the state, our state, over the authority of extra state actors. I don't disagree with anything you just said. In fact, I don't think I could have said it better. I certainly tried, but I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. It is a shame that we as a country don't have the capacity to deal with this guy alive. It speaks to our weakness as a country. I don't have a problem with spending that money on tracking this guy down, per se. But it is a shame that we'd made no attempt to capture him. And that we state it that we didn't make an attempt. I think it's a shame. How long until austerity in the U.S. leads to what we are seeing in U.K.?
those riots that are happening right now have nothing
to
do with
that. You're not on, I don't think.
I'm on.
Okay,
come
now
on.
You are.
Really? That was weird. It was all the way up. Those riots going on in London have nothing to do with that right now.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Really?
Look, I think that the trigger was not. The trigger was a guy getting shot. But there's two things. There's two elements that you're not contemplating. One is it's in the air. Protest and anger is in the air. And it's spread all around the city. And it is anti-authoritarian. And that in and of itself is born out of this. The second thing you're not contemplating is this story that I have right here, Matt, person who doesn't apparently know anything about Justin Bieber.
I don't know. From what I'm hearing about these riots, it's just a bunch of kids taking the opportunity to loot because they were a protest that did start thanks to due to a guy who got shot. But the majority of these people don't even give a shit about that. They're just stealing shit.
Right. No, I think that's true.
Like, there's no political motive behind this particular riot.
No, there's no necessarily political motive, but there is a certain amount of poor people who are involved in this, and that doesn't happen in a vacuum. People get angry when they are subjected to austerity, and you mix that anger with an opportunity, and this is what you get. Not to mention, Susie Madrick points out, in September of last year, this is right on the eve of austerity, British Home Secretary Theresa May refused to accept claims by the British police that austerity cuts would affect their ability to contain civil unrest. The British public don't simply resort to violent unrest in the face of challenging economic circumstances, she said. But you cut 40,000 police staff jobs and you diminish the police's ability to contain these things. And violence begets violence. And protest against governments begets protest against governments. I mean, this is the way these things start sometimes.
I mean, if you want to say that the cuts to the police force are reasons why this is spreading, then I could see that definitely. I mean, I was reading that there were more people, there were more police for the royal wedding than they even had at the height of what's going on in these riots. But I look at these rioters as no better than the Vancouver people who rioted because their hockey team lost. This isn't. From everything
I've
read.
Why is it so widespread in the city? I mean, the point is that is this a completely heterogeneous group of people, or is there some consistency in terms of where they are in terms of economic status or whatnot? Or is there a sense? I mean, look, I don't necessarily have to be protesting cuts to Medicare or rioting because of cuts to Medicare, let's say, or because of my health services or because of my jobs. Or when you have 0% growth and rising unemployment, I'm not necessarily responding to that, but that puts me in a state that makes it more likely when people are starting to throw shit at TV stores, that I'm going to join them. That's the point. They're not necessarily out there rioting because of these cuts, or I should say in response to these cuts, but they may be out there rioting because they are subjected to these cuts.
I don't know, but I can't. I mean,
well, maybe we should get somebody on to report on it.
Oh, definitely. But because to me, I mean, when you have a riot like this, I mean, there needs to be something or reason. I mean, I'm all for it. I mean, if there's a political motive, if you're just rioting against an injustice, like if it was actually because that guy got shot and everyone came together to riot against this. But these are just people who are breaking into small businesses. There's pictures of people stealing pairs of pants.
Oh, no, no.
I mean,
I'm not justifying it. You're missing my point. I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying he's right to do that. But that doesn't mean that it isn't a function of these cuts. I mean, this is, in fact, the dynamic that brings about social change, which is when they are nervous, when the leaders of a society become nervous that their actions are leading to this, not that it's justified or not justified. I mean, this isn't civil disobedience we're talking about. Let's go to the IMs because I think people want to weigh in on this.
I mean, if they were attacking, you know, like government buildings or whatever, if they were like rioting against government buildings or things like that because of these, even if it's not the reason, just in the back of their mind because of the situation they're in, but that's not what they're doing. We don't know that. They're attacking people, their own people, their own class.
It doesn't matter though. That doesn't matter, because just because they are not rational in terms of their political agenda, or even aware of it, doesn't mean that the cuts haven't put them in that situation. I mean, look, if I cut your electricity off, and you're stuck in 105 degree heat, I mean, the fact of the matter is that crime and rioting goes up in the summer. It just does. If I cut off your, if you can't pay your electricity bill, and I cut off assistance to providing electricity, you may not be rioting because I cut off assistance to your ability to pay electricity. But the fact that you're sitting sweltering in 105 degree heat in your apartment may actually be a contributing factor to your violence. So yeah, that's the point.
But I'm not going to go and break into my neighbor's house because he's got air conditioning.
Some elements of society may go out and steal an air conditioner. I mean, you're conflating two things. There is no doubt that it adds to social unrest. We see this time and time again. Otherwise, this woman back in September would not even be addressing it. Is it the only factor? Obviously not. Is it a factor? Yes. Would it mitigate it? If all these people had jobs, I mean, I can tell you this. I can say this without knowing any of the hard data. The vast majority of those people do not have jobs. I can almost guarantee you that. Because people with jobs don't go out and riot. People who are living comfortably or do not feel economic stress don't go out and riot. That's simply the fact. And so the more people you add to that status of being economically stressed, the more likely this is to happen. That doesn't mean that that's why they're going out and doing it. But it is something that happens.
Maybe it's just disappointment on my end because, I mean, with everything that's going on and all this talk about how there's going to be unrest and everything, you see these pictures and I almost like want to hope that, like, oh, man, this is what you'd imagine. But there'd be a message behind it. There'd be a reason for it. I mean, you want to think back, like think in the future, think the history books will put this down as this is when the people saw what was going on and they were sick and tired of it. But then you see the pictures and you know their reasoning for it and there's no justification and it just makes them look like fucking idiots.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I also I don't know if things like this don't actually have more impact on society. When the people are wilding, that's when the leaders go like, oh, shit. We can't even deal with this in the context of the political process. I mean, that's the reality of it. When we got, the New Deal was an attempt to head off this type of unrest.